So Dan, how have you been?
I've been okay. Been playing through, Plutonia,
Yeah?
Sunlust, all these good Doom mods.
I finally sat down and decided, yeah, I'm gonna play through Plutonia. And that was good. I was glad. Wasn't as hard as I was led to believe, but it's been 20 years, so
Hit scanners.
hit scanners, man,
Ugh.
those damn chain gunners.
Sunlust is pretty fun up until I got to level 10, and I definitely felt it when I had three cyber demons sitting in front of me. It's like, yeah, time to get good. And this is totally Sunlust
It's
right
pretty amazing how something from 30 years ago can still bring you so much joy. Speaking of joy from things that are old, I mean, you read any good books lately?
I read Far Country.
I did too. It's a pretty good book. What about Hour of the Wolf?
We're talking about good books here. Shots fired.
The bird is the word. So for those of you guys who don't know, Far Country is a novel that came out. The first printing was October 1993, according to the inside cover of the book. And it is usually lampooned and looked down upon,
Oh, it is infamous in the BattleTech lineup of books.
because it features a sentient alien race. And the main thing about BattleTech is that there are not sentient aliens. Although I think in one source book, I think there was an allusion to sort of a semi-primate species on a planet that.
Yes, I believe is in one of the MechWarrior rule books,
Yeah, I have
or
to
one of
look.
the supplements.
Yeah, I have to look back and see which one that was. But yeah, with Far Country, the bird-like alien race are refer to themselves as the Te'Tate. Which I guess is like an Australian reference too.
Yeah, I believe it is. I don't remember though. What the specific reference is? Did they mention it in the book?
They didn't
In
mention
Far
in the
Country?
book. Someone, one of the new writers, her name is Faith, and she's recently published in Shrapnel number 4. Did mention it, I think, on the boards. So I have to go back and look at like what they
That's super
said.
cool.
BattleTech is an IP that does not have sentient alien races, similar to say Dune, where it's people, right? Everything is
Yes.
people. You'll leave the alien races to other science fiction series, but in my mind, that's okay with this in this book because they sort of deal with that. And once you get past that, it's a good book.
I thought it was a good book. I really thought it was.
Well, there's actually characters in it that have internal consistency and have reactions
Well,
that make sense.
first of all, I don't know if you guys are actually going to care too much about this, but there are definitely going to be spoilers.
Well, we'll get to the spoiler part. When we get there, we'll get there. We'll mention it.
Yeah. But, okay, so Far Country basically has a plot.
Well, and things happen that make sense, and there are characters that are well defined and have character arcs, and the decisions they make sense based
Their
on.
situation that they're in, which happens to be a misjump. Actually, there are two misjumps in the book.
So we're not quite in spoilers yet.
We're
We'll get
getting
to
there.
So the book opens with. So the main thing is that Far Country is tells a story where these sentient aliens, you're never gonna have to worry about it in BattleTech, which is what makes it okay. You're not gonna see the Te'Tate anywhere else because this misjump, I mean, you don't know what happens, right? I mean,
No.
it's described as being like a really weird cosmic event. And the navigational computers of the jump ships have no idea where they're located. Are they a different dimension? Is it the other side of the galaxy?
And they allude to all of that.
And the jump ships are completely wrecked. There's no way for any of them to get back. And the Tetate are, you know, the equivalent of an Amazonian tribe when it comes to their technology level. I mean, they have a culture, which is
a belief system.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's more than what we got in religion. Some other recent books in terms of how a society functions.
They definitely have more personality than the clans do.
Yeah, yeah, they do. Everybody has more personality than the clans. Jesus. No.
Can't tell. Adam's having a beer right now.
I am. I am. Oh, boy, it's 7%. All right.
Oh, yeah, it's go time. Yeah. We're talking about Far Country.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the main thing is that people don't like it because of the Centennialian race. And once you get past that, it's a book that flows and I would say seems to be well-paced and has suspense and has characters and has defined characters that are different from each other, has character arcs, you know, and it the characters change and evolve, and the ones that don't have their failings, and it's basically what makes it a novel. You know, it's not a series of events connected by, and then this happens, and then this happens, and then this happens.
Now something happens, and then the character has to struggle through it. And you have, the other thing with this book is, it's not just one storyline, so to say.
Yeah.
There, you know, each character kind of has their own story in the book.
Yeah.
You have, you know, Vost, you have Seagroves, Takuda, who else?
Well, that's one of the things about Far Country is that,
yeah,
there are a lot of characters, but you only follow so many of them. And so other characters are named and listed, but because they're not the focus, they don't get a lot of screen time. So the characters that you do focus on become developed. And you understand them and how they think.
But the other thing, too, is even the characters that are there for a short time, you get a grasp of their personality.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little bit lazy with the book because they just lay it out to you. But, I mean, if it's just a one-off character, you kind of have to do that.
Yeah, you don't want to spend too much word count dealing with it. And I think if you're willing to understand that the birds are not going to play a part in any future BattleTech product, and this is really just a one-off story, straight up, and it involves this group of people from the BattleTech universe that are transported somewhere completely different, then cool. You know, put the sentient aliens to the side and just read the book. You might be surprised. Because to me, I don't know about you, Dan, but I mean, when I read it, I get the feel of really a Star Trek book, like a Star Trek storyline with BattleTech window dressing, because you've got an alien species, a previous human settlement, the conflicts between them, the conflicts between the multiple human settlements, and then the newcomers that have to try and figure their way through this world. You know,
you can tell that Peter Rice was definitely influenced by Star Trek and Dune.
Yeah.
In this book.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not a book where the only answer is to shoot your way through it, because the protagonists don't have an endless supply of weapons and backups. And they talk about that, and they talk about their limitations and the resources they have that are limited.
They definitely don't have plot armor.
They definitely do not have plot armor. Yeah, definitely not.
There are actual consequences for, I mean, these characters and their actions.
Jesus, man, they ran out of coffee.
Yeah, that can you imagine that?
That is fucking awful.
And the alcohol on the planet's terrible.
Oh, oof. It's rough. It's rough. And that's the future. So I think from here on out, there's going to be spoilers. But if at any point there is any interest if there's been a spark of a little bit of interest that this book is worth reading and you don't need to listen to the rest of this.
Yeah, you might want to stop now and just go read it.
Yeah.
Because essentially you're in the discussion.
300 pages? It's over 300 pages. I mean, that's not all that much. But it's
very easy to read.
It's an easy read. And I think, you know, I was telling you, Dan, one of the things I really liked about it is that we see sort of a human side to the Draconis Combine and the culture that doesn't necessarily seep through. Because you think Draconis Combine, you think samurais, you think the Kintaro's Massacre, you know, tea ceremonies, I guess.
Yeah, you see Dest in a whole different light.
Yeah, yeah, they're not just...
They're actual people.
Yeah, they're not just the uber soldiers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the personality conflict between them and the mercenaries that they were assigned to.
Side note, I think mercenaries were portrayed pretty good in this book.
Yeah, they're definitely...
I would assume that most of the mercenary, not like the famous ones we get, but most of them are shitheads.
Yeah. Because in the battle, it's like, what mercenaries do you think? Okay, great, it's Legion. Oh, your Grayson Carlisle's fighting against the barbaric hordes, bringing knowledge to everybody. You think of the Kellhounds, relatives to...
Quirky Snords or regulars.
Yeah, Quirky Snords or regulars. The Wolf's Dragoons, the uberest of uber mercenaries.
But no, you got Vost and Seagroves.
Yeah,
two assholes.
You get this ground level look at a small lance of characters. And then the mercenaries are all different too. But they're not the altruistic type that we see maybe too often. Yeah.
And that is old school BattleTech right there. Just a lance.
Just a lance. Not just like a lance.
A whole regiment
yeah.
of units and a mercenary.
So yeah. So from here on out, spoilers. So if you want to listen to the rest of this, great. It's probably going to be a relatively shorter podcast. A shorter episode. But if there's any interest at all, go ahead, pick it up. Just remember that these alien birds are not going to be showing up anywhere else. So if you have any worry about what it's going to mean for BattleTech, it's not going to affect it. And the book came out in 93. It's almost 20 years ago. And the Teitate haven't shown up anywhere else. Don't fucking worry about it. Just put it off the side and read the book and enjoy it. So yeah, spoilers from here on out. So yeah, Dan, favorite parts?
There was one part that stuck out to me. And they were all essentially desperate, and the Teitate led leftovers from Dest, like Takuda and, you know, whatever was left over of his crew at that time. And they stole two locusts
from
the mercenaries. They were able to pull them out of the wreckage. Mm-hmm. And one of them didn't it take a cockpit shot?
Yeah, because one of them, the female mech warrior, Goodall, attacked, I think it was the other Locust pilot, I think it was Brands or Brank or something.
Yeah.
They just basically, you know, killed with a cockpit shot.
The names really aren't that memorable. They're just kind of like thrown in there.
Yeah.
But it brought me back to the episode that we had about glazing windows.
We were talking about how
that would work in the universe. Yeah. And what they had to do was these birds basically gave them crystals from this cave, and they relied on them to show them how to make those crystals in the glass that they could repurpose for the cockpit of the Locust.
Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting. Mm. The other thing I liked too was that it actually showed that the Teitate weren't just in this book just to be in there. Like they were actually doing things.
Yeah.
They were actually moving the plot forward.
Right.
You know, they were helping Dest where they could.
Yes. That scene was, to me, when you've made an ally with a native species that know this landscape and know its resources and know what humans can eat, what they can't eat. What I liked about the Teitate as well was the fact that they had a culture. You know, they had, you know, it was a culture that seemed primitive, but at the same time relied on an oral tradition. Like they were like us, but maybe 5,000 years, you know, early. You know, we're looking at humans from 5,000 years ago, where It's Stone Age tools, but it's an oral tradition. And they take their ceremonies very
Oh,
seriously.
yeah.
They don't have a religious concept of good and evil the way that we do, you know, as a result of probably I'm probably mostly a Judeo-Christian mindset, but sort of things happen because of nature, and you know, there's it's so you take it as you go, and there's different tribes and the way they interact with each other, and it's really cool that Peter Rice, the author, took the time to flesh that out. It wasn't just they're part of the landscape and they're just there. They're not just talking chickens, right?
Exactly.
They have a culture. They know how to communicate. They're skilled at tasks. They've got good hand-eye coordination. Well, and to be birds too, right? Because what's one of the few animal species that can be tool users? It's like corvids, ravens, and crows.
Yep. The other, I liked how, well, in their ceremony, Takuda actually has to sit there and participate in it. And it was like hours
It was like
long.
18 hours. He's like, I can't.
Yeah.
He's like, I
He's
can't
like, I
fucking do
can't do
this.
this anymore.
It's
But it, what I
like
thought,
this could have been an email.
yeah, you wish. But I thought it was neat because wasn't that something they used to do in ancient Greece? They used to pass a lot of things down through oral tradition, almost like
Well,
folklore.
because I part of the idea with the well, one, there's the Homeric hymns, which may not have actually been written by the poet Homer.
Yeah.
But then you have the Iliad and the Odyssey, which were supposedly originally, you know, oral tradition. I mean, and the Iliad and the Odyssey, they are not short books by any stretch. I mean, especially the Iliad. I mean, the Iliad is massive. And yeah, it was supposedly in oral tradition first.
Which is, they didn't get to handwriting yet. Any
Yeah,
of that.
I think
Well,
I have to remember on what, like, Linear A, Linear B, the Phoenician alphabet, and when the Greek alphabet began to take form. But I think the idea is that the Iliad predates writing. So
Yeah. And they're and the other thing too, I their religion, which we're going to get to the ending of the book. But the Ditate religion is actually based off of the first myths jump.
yeah, at
Because
least they're prophecies and stuff like that, but
exactly.
yeah.
Like that was, and that's actually where they learned how to speak because they came in contact with the first settlers from the mist jump.
I think they had their own language, but they learned English.
Yeah. They have, well, that's what I mean. They had their own way of communicating, but that's why, like, when who was it in Des that met Dakota?
I think was it Horg was the first one?
I think, yeah. I think it was Horg. The bird just starts speaking English to him. It's like, wait, what?
It blew his mind. You sort of do feel it. It does come through the page of how gobsmacked he is. He's like, what? What's happening? Why is this bird speaking English to me? Part of the thing about the book is that the first couple chapters move really fast. You know, you kind of get the idea that the first, you know, the prologue starts with the first mist jump from whatever planet it is.
Yeah, it was like Star League era when it
Yeah,
happened.
it
Yeah.
was yeah, or maybe even before the Star League, because it was like 2510 or something.
Yeah.
So it was really, really early. This was oh yeah, it was it's Salford, the planet Salford, in 2510. And this was before, I think. Yeah, this was before the BattleTech novels had the format where the beginning of the chapter would start with the time, date, planetary location, the province it was in, and the whatever successor
Well, it does
city
the book
was.
the favor because you really don't know where they're at.
Right.
If you really think about it. Even without that, the book does definitely have a
Oh, and then there we
has
go.
that.
Yeah, and then in Part one, when it begins, once you get to the first chapter, it's in 3056. So when the characters that we follow, then it's 3056. But yeah, the other thing that I really liked about Far Country was that Rice did enough foreshadowing and setup to see where things were going. So when you get to the ending, it doesn't feel as though it's out of nowhere, and it doesn't feel as though the characters' responses are just for the plot. You know, like another certain book that ended in a certain way where a character suddenly felt dumbstruck and dumbfounded that his whole plan ended up working exactly how he wanted it to. And yet he's upset that he pushed the opposing character into a position,
Adam,
where he could only take that route and was surprised that it worked out that way and therefore felt dumb because his plan worked. I didn't like Hour of the Wolf, guys.
I didn't really like it either.
Yeah.
Either.
Yeah, I mean, we see... So for those of you not that know, 2510, that doesn't necessarily predate Battlemax, does it? But it predates the Draconis Combine's access to Battlemax?
I believe so.
Yeah, or at least widespread access to Battlemax. So when this first Draconis Combine regiment... you know, misjumps, and you think about how much support personnel comes to the regiment, that's probably enough, you know, even with a dropship lost, that's probably enough to make a viable count. There's probably enough genetic diversity to make it work. Mm-hmm. And it's, I like how you see the different parts of Draconis Combine society begin to fragment and then consolidate into three settlements driven by different mindsets, you know, orthodoxies.
Different, yeah, a different form of rule, a different sort of economy.
Mm-hmm.
They also have a different way that they treat the Titate. Most of them are pretty much slaves.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're servants, right, because they see them as below them.
Yeah.
Which is why when Takuda and his crew, like they and the mercenaries, when they crash land, that they actually almost worship them,
right,
because it's part of a prophecy that they're gonna basically land and liberate them.
Yeah, well, liberate. And also Takuda, or maybe it's Takuda. I mean Japanese pronunciation.
Yeah, if we butcher it, we butcher it.
But Takuda and the rest of the Dest troopers don't treat the Taitate like shit. That's mm-hmm. probably enough for them to like them, right?
Which ends up working for them. We'll get to that.
yeah, I know you picked up on it, Dan. But one of the things I liked about the book is that, you know, to kind of backtrack again, is that stuff is laid out and there are consequences to actions. You know, you've got a Lance of Battlemax. You've got a Lamb. I think one of the few books where we get to see Land Air Max in action.
Yeah, and they're pretty detailed about it, too.
Yeah, there's a lot of details in how a Lamb cockpit's set up and how it functions. But, you know, these battle mechs, you know, they don't have access to new ammunition. The Lamb doesn't have access to more fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And so every hour that Lamb is airborne, it has consequences.
Yeah, and Seagroves knows that, and he knows he's at an advantage for having a Lamb as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because all he really has, again, he has a Phoenix Hawk Lamb.
Yeah.
Which is the best one that you can get, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know, Vost has a Panther, and then who's the other guy? He has a Javelin.
Yeah, Pesht.
And Pesht knows that his Javelin can only work for so long.
He only has so many missiles.
Yeah, he only has so much, so he's, you know, reserving his shots the best that he can.
And Voss even comments, you know, yeah, I've got SRMs too,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not sharing them with Pesht. So it's one of those things, like the mercenaries are all trying to work together, but they're also all working against each other. And there's the fifth mech warrior that dies, Brands or whatever.
Yeah.
It was just sort of a sycophant to Vost. But the three men, because Goodall, who was a female, was like, fuck Vost. He's an asshole. He's a misogynist. He's a bigot. And I mean, it's one of those things is...
The first thing this dude's worried about is populating the planet. Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, that is the first thing he alludes to.
The dude's a real piece of shit. A real piece of shit. And I think it's funny, too, that... It starts off like that, and you think, "Oh my God, what's happening? Like, what's going on with this?
What am I getting into?"
And then, like, very quickly, it's made very clear that no, like, you know, Takuda, the Dest commander, is very egalitarian, and he you know, esteems the women in his command very highly because they're all very skilled. But then Voss is like, hey, pussy.
Yeah. Big titties. Get over here.
And he is just a fucking frat bro.
It still is a lazy way to get you to hate somebody, you know, but yeah. It works for the book.
It works for the book. It works
unlike for the book. The other one.
Yeah. but yeah.
Anyway.
You see the characters all have their flaws, and you know, Takuda, of course, dealing with the fact that, you know, he's a desk commander in the Draconis Combine, which is a very top-down organizational structure.
Oh, yeah, he's struggling with his training at points.
Yeah. You know, being in charge now and not having anyone above him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like he has to adapt. I think my favorite villain, though, is Seagroves. I like him a lot, the Lamb Pilot.
Yeah.
He's just worried about money.
Right.
He's kind of like Bronn in Game of Thrones.
Yeah. And of course, in the end, right, the whole point is that the thing that he finds valuable is not valuable at all.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing's going to change that.
Yeah, with the Lamb, it's clever.
Yeah.
How they build up to it.
And so when you get to the end and you see that last paragraph, you know, the way it goes down, it makes sense how you get there, because all these mercenaries, despite working as a team, are also out only for themselves. And at any point, things could go, you know, upside down for them. Yeah.
Yeah, so like Seagroves is basically obsessed with gold because he thinks he's going to end up home at some point.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing is, they're just handing it to him because there's no value with gold on... I think it's just on the planet in general with the three societies. I think they're more concerned about, what was it, like iron ore?
Yeah, and I mean, iron, to be honest, iron's probably plentiful on the planet because iron's a common component in the universe. But
they're almost primitive as well.
Right.
And so it's important to them to have it.
And it's quite possible, I think it's alluded to, that access to the iron mines is actually really, really limited because it's one of the head families of one of the cities.
Yeah.
Basically controls the access to the iron mines. So yeah, I like how. So there's a thing in writing called the Chekhov gun. So sort of if you see a gun in one scene, and then it's mentioned in the next, by the third scene it needs to be fired. So sort of the idea that you're alluding to something, and it's got to go somewhere, and so. Like with the Lamb, they're constantly mentioning about the fuel and being careful about it. And it's not being shoved down your throat all the time, but it does come up frequently enough that this is going to be a problem. And in the end, it is a problem. And it's not...
Seagirl's problem.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the other thing too is it's not that it has to be televised or it doesn't have to be like projected at you and screaming at you, but it's sort of... You know, you've been paying attention.
Yeah, well, look at it this way. When you get that low fuel signal on your car, like, you understand it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's basically how it comes about in this book. Like, it's slowly like, okay, you know the gauge is getting lower and lower with this.
Yeah.
You know, and it's also getting at a point where they're starting to realize, you know, maybe we're not going to get off of this planet.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the same thing for Desk, because they're actually struggling with that too.
Right.
You know, they're starting to become desperate because they've been fighting for so long against the mercenaries. That, you know, they're starting to wonder that.
Yeah. Because the mercenaries, they go to the cities, the cities want their aid. The cities are really worried about what might happen because now they're losing control of their own population to these crazy new guys in the woods that are promising some sort of new society.
Now they're actually worried about the birds.
Yeah.
Because the birds are starting to get the word.
Because the bird is the word. So yeah, I would say in the end, I mean, Far Country, it's actually a novel. It's not just a list of events. And if you guys look up it on YouTube, there is a short video. So the guys from South Park, Matt Parker and Trey Stone, that's their names? Or is it Trey Stone and...
Trey Stone and Matt Parker. Yeah. He just had it flipped.
So they go to this, they just surprise this writing class at a university, and they kind of have a breakdown of what makes a good story work. And if you've got these scenes or these events or these beats, you have the cats running around like crazy.
Yeah, she took a dump.
So you have these beats, and if in between the beats you have and then and then and then, you've got a problem. You don't have a story. You just have a series of events that are just happening just because. But if you have between the events but this happens, therefore this happens, then you have a story. Then you have consequences and you have action, reaction to the events. The characters are not passive players in a list of shit that just happens. And so Far Country does that better than some other recent books.
You know what? What was I just thinking of with the Titate? Now, man, now I'm drawing a blank. Because you keep making me think of Howard a Wolf, and it just does that to you. You're just like, oh my God. It was so hard to just pick up on that story. I think the getting back on the lamb. So essentially, like what happens with it, this is a big spoiler because it kind of leads up to the end. Seagroves knows that obviously he's running out of fuel.
Yeah.
And they're getting to the point where they know they're probably not going to leave the planet. So all of a sudden that lamb is not valuable anymore. And he's already putting himself in a position where he's essentially being worshipped.
Yeah.
So he gets in this like argument with Vost.
Yeah.
And it basically turns into a cock waving contest for Vost. What was Vost like trying to do?
Well,
like,
I think
show him up or something.
There was something with trying to locate the fleeing Dest group. With the mm-hmm. one locus, the group of Tetate, and then any of the followers from the settlements that were going to go with them. And Seagroves had already yanked out the fuel warning light.
Yeah.
Because he knew where he was at. He was tired of looking at it and tired of hearing mm-hmm. it.
And this is where the argument with Vost comes in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They never got the light repaired.
Nope. He tore it out.
He tore it out, yeah. It was still in his pocket.
And the thing is, like, Vost, he knew how to pilot one. He wasn't as experienced.
Yeah, and he didn't have one.
Exactly.
Thing, yeah.
So, yeah, I forget why he gets in the lamb.
I think it was because he was getting frustrated that Seagroves was not doing the work.
Okay, yeah. And it basically turned into this big argument, and he takes the lamb and essentially runs out of fuel, and yep. Seagroves is just there laughing. He just yep. crashes right into the mountainside. And
yep. Okay, the funny thing too is the lamb ended up kind of becoming a testament to Seagroves' greed, mm-hmm. because as the lamb is crashing and as it's run out of fuel and it's in a complete nosedive, like one of the compartments in the cockpit opens and this giant gold like cup falls right in front of Vost's face, and he's like, what?
Yeah, he like weighed it down.
Yeah. Man.
Yeah, the other I like too.
The other thing is, getting back to some of the characters that are fleshed out, because we don't see too much about Pesht. Mm-hmm. And so there's a whole chapter devoted to Pesht's back dealings with the other leaders of the other communities.
Yeah, he's more of the like the sparrow, like he's kind of behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Trying to one up everybody. You know, he just
kind of like a Littlefinger.
Yeah, Littlefinger. I don't think he was as clever as Seagroves was though. Because I think Seagroves was primarily just trying to get rid of Vost.
No, I think in the heat of the moment at the time, Seagroves didn't even think about the fuel.
I don't even think
he was thinking about the fuel. Yeah.
I think
Pesht was probably the most clever of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
But where Vost was so the most gregarious and therefore was kind of the leader. And Seagroves was just... Well, Vost would sort of lead just by force of will. You know, everyone kind of got behind him.
They would almost just kind of let him do it.
Yeah.
Let him do his thing.
But yeah, Seagroves was really the greedy guy and the glutton. Yeah. Yeah.
He was the one who mentioned how bad the alcohol was
yeah.
on the planet.
Do you remember the scene when they first get Dakota and he's injured because there was that firefight? And it was because the mercenary scout team on foot was basically being assholes. And they were kind of parallel to the Dest team.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they saw also a Tetate. And so they freaked out and started shooting at it. And then the firefight, Dakota got injured, and
it was the guy that met him that brought him back.
Yeah, so they brought him back, and Takuto was looking at him, and he was getting weaker and weaker and weaker. And Takuto ordered some medical supplies, just basically to use, and just keep injecting whatever this is until it responds. Of course, and there's a big question mark. What about biology? What about how this drug is? If this drug reacts at all, or acts at all on this bird thing's biology, is it even beneficial, or is it detrimental? And there was one of the officers there said, "But that's Draconis Combine property, and it can only be used on a member of the DCMS." And it was sort of this, "What do we do?" And it sounds kind of silly, right? But they don't know where they're at. They don't know if they're ever going to get back home, if they're going to be found. They don't know if they'll get in trouble for doing this. And
it's basically where like Takuda realizes, I have to be in charge.
And... Yeah, because it's also sort of they're what they've been ordered to do. I mean, it's not something they can just switch off, and they make a decision to do so. But sort of wrestling with that.
But that's something that actually comes to help them in the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is a consequence for that.
But that sort of internal struggle is something that is nice to see, because sometimes you don't see that.
Yeah, Peter does a good job laying all of that out. You see the internal struggle with Takuda, you know, coming to terms with their situation. Even after all the battles when they're essentially losing.
Yeah.
You know, they end up losing.
Right.
Yeah, so like you follow him throughout that whole struggle, you know, and this is where the book kind of comes full circle. So before you get into that, another thing I really liked about it too was how the Titate, like they had this like, what were we calling it? Like prophecy.
Yeah.
And another thing that kind of cemented that, well, it was starting to drive Takuta nuts because he didn't think he deserved that kind of status with him. He was a real humble guy.
Yeah, yeah. Takuta, for being the leader of this Dest group, and you know, Dest being kind of touted as one of the scarier special forces groups in the Inner Sphere. Takuta is a really just through and through good person, which is nice to see. Because we had a whole book full of shitty people we had to read recently.
Yeah.
Where no one was likable.
But I liked how...
And I don't care what any motherfuckers say. I hated those goddamn tankers.
Well, the birds are more useful than the tankers.
Seriously.
They are way more useful and have way more personality, even though they could barely speak English.
Yeah.
But what I really did like about it was the locusts kind of looked like them.
Right.
That was part of their prophecy. They were like almost worshiping these locusts.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like they didn't really like, they cared a bit about the Phoenix Hawk Lamb, but for some reason, like the locusts like stuck out to them just because they had the long legs like them. And I almost wish that they were actually Hussars, because Hussars are almost like identical. That was probably before the design even existed. You know, when they were coming up with the book, but whatever the reason was, I think that would have been a lot better. But the locusts, like they were even like fighting beside them.
Yeah,
you know, because it was almost like a rally cry for them.
And they would huddle around the locusts and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah,
they would like have their stories around them. And it was cool to actually see a battle mech actually portrayed like a mythological being, you know, or like the horse, like you know, like a knight's horse,
right?
Right. You know, which is kind of lost as the books go along, as battle mechs just, we have so many designs now and so many variants that whole feel was lost.
Well, you go back to Thunder Rift, Decision of Thunder Rift, and the fight in that city against the locust with the infantry, you know, and how scary the locust was. Mm-hmm. And yet ways you could get around that and terrify the locust pilot. Yeah, you don't get too much of that sort of, I don't know, it doesn't feel like you get a lot of the awe that is sometimes described in the material that comes with the rule books. But here you do sort of see it again, and you see it from, I don't want to say like a childlike species, because that's a little bit maybe unfair, but you know, a species that is a little bit earlier along its developmental path than human beings. And so they see this massive, yeah, they see this massive thing. And they're like, whoa, it looks like us.
Yeah. And it's actually taking out the, what were the tanks like powered by?
Oh, they're like steam, they were steam powered.
They were like terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, the locusts, and they're just like dominating until, you know, the mercenaries started
showing up. Yeah.
Showing up and fighting Takuda and the, you know, his locusts and that. So like they slowly, while the mercenaries are making deals with these three like cities or civilizations, I should say, like they're slowly fighting back and forth with Takuda. I mean, they're, and it's almost like they like fear the mercenaries.
Yeah.
And they kind of like showed their value. So it's like even these civilizations, like, yeah, they're all kind of like working together to fight Takuda and the Titate. Yeah. And at the same time, like they're also like conspiring behind one another.
Yeah.
Cause they're, you know, they know how powerful the mercenaries are. So they're almost like watching their own. Like, it's almost very, the book itself to me is very Mad Max. You know, I felt like someone was going to be on that steam power tank yelling, "Witness me," as the freaking locust like just burns it. But it also had that almost like a little bit of a Game of Thrones vibe, like just the politics behind it.
A lot of back and forth. So yeah, one city was like Staley's fastest at the Draconis Combine. So one city is a mercantilist city, you know, driven by capitalism. So then, of course, you take capitalism to extremes. I mean, you have the haves and the have-nots.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the theocratic city, sort of based off of, I mean, I get the impression more like Shinto Buddhism, but maybe I'm just totally off the wall, but sort of those aspects of Japanese religion that would have been brought on by the dominance of Japanese culture, or an incorrect look at what feudalism would have been like, Japanese yeah. feudalism would have been like,
say, like
later on the Draconis Combine. And then you have the military dictatorship as if it was the coordinator himself running it, so that very, you know, autocratic, top-down military feel that you kind of get, it seems kind of pervasive throughout the Draconis Combine.
And they all need each other.
Yeah.
They all do.
They do. Yeah. They're not, their economies are not diversified enough to get by.
And the reason Titate are willing to work with Takuda, one, because they saved Dakota.
Yeah.
But the other thing too, is that when these settlements first landed on the planet, they basically enslaved, like they didn't know what tribes.
To eat. Well, and I wonder too, if the part of the thing with the Titate was a look back at, or analogous to Native Americans.
Yeah, yeah. It has a very Native American vibe because there are different tribes.
Yeah.
And the ones that were primarily conquered were the, they called them like, what were it, like the Plains tribes?
Or yeah, something? Yeah, they were like near the rivers. Because mm-hmm. Yeah, at first the Titate helped them, teach them or tell them what they can eat and what they can't eat.
Yeah, and they turn around and enslave them.
So, yeah, yeah. Man.
Yeah, if that doesn't speak to human history.
So there's a couple different layers to all this stuff. So, okay. Yeah.
So that all comes full circle in the book, too.
Yeah.
Because that's where a lot of her legends come from.
Yeah.
You know, the fire in the sky, so to say. Right. And, you know, when Takuda essentially saves Dakota and they work together, they're in a desperate spot. Yeah. And there you go, because they lose to the mercenaries. And basically, they decide to go with in the end, Takuda's like, you know what, man? I don't know where else they're going to go with this. I'm just going to go with their prophecy.
Yeah.
You know, and
you might as well see if there's anything else over the mountains.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, they go on this real long, like, grueling journey to get there.
Yeah.
And they end up finding, which they describe it in the first part of the book when they're describing the crashes with the dropships.
Yeah.
And they actually find one of them.
Yeah, because you assume they're both lost, both those dropships. Mm-hmm. That. So when the weird things about Far Country, and so maybe it is a completely different dimension, because maybe the rules of physics are a bit different. So when a jump ship jumps or a warship in the good BattleTech novel Icons of War, when a jump ship or warship makes a jump, it arrives in the new system with zero inertia. There is no acceleration, no velocity, any of that. But when these jump ships, because of whatever cosmic event happens, the jump ship is in a state of acceleration, or it's moving towards the planet. And so the question is it, are they arriving as the planet is coming towards them? Is it the jump ship has, you know, some sort of acceleration? Mm-hmm. But they have to get off that jump ship ASAP. And I mean, in the end, the jump ships are just derelict, still floating, so they get caught in some sort of gravity and they're orbiting. But yeah, I mean, those jump ships get entangled with each other in the docking collars and they collide with each other. So yeah, we assumed that both those drop ships were wrecked. There's only one of them mm-hmm. that was unrecoverable.
Which, you know, that's what they've described in their legend yeah. they were talking about. And they do that, it's close to the beginning. Mm-hmm. When they're all sitting around the fire and they're talking about, you know, the history of their race. But yeah, like they talk about how, I might get this wrong, but essentially they see that dropship, but they, you know, they don't know what it is. So they're yeah. thinking it's like some meteor, like, yeah. you know, some fireball in the sky or some god. And it, you know, it crashes over the mountainside, you know, and it's really neat because the solution was in front of them the whole time.
Yeah.
But because the mercenaries were so quick to look down on them and see them as primitive, as stupid, kind of like how people judge this book, just look down on it because there's this sentient race in it.
Yeah.
Takuta, in the end, is able to go against basically everything he knows. He's pushed to give up and just takes a chance.
Right.
To get to actually listens to them and they're able to get out.
To get to the far country. The other yep. the moon / planet that's in the same.
And that is a good ending.
Yeah.
You know, really good ending.
It's one of those things where, you know, like I was telling you earlier, you know, some people say, you know, with BattleTech, it's not that the novels have gotten worse, it's just that you're no longer 12 years old. And I mean, I get it, you know, I don't expect the BattleTech, you know, novels to be, you know, Dune. I don't expect it to be, you know, something super layered like Game of Thrones. Not expecting Moby Dick. Mm-hmm. But I am expecting something that's good and is consistent and flows and has, you know, the but therefore connectors between scenes so that things that happen for a reason and the reactions to those happen for some sort of logical consistency.
Yeah, I wanted to know what was going to happen to Takuta.
Yeah, you want to see what the end.
As shitty as the mercenaries were, I wanted to know what was going to happen to them too.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, especially Seagroves, because he reminded me of Bronn, which is like one of my favorite characters from Game of Thrones.
So yeah, when you see him at where those mercenaries end up and what they're doing at the end, it makes sense. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like it's off the wall. They have their motivations and how they get there, you know, matters. You know, one of the things I worried about when I was growing up, I had this sort of moment of crisis, especially with BattleTech, right? Because, you know, I love BattleTech so much, was, okay, I'm reading this and I enjoy it, but do I enjoy it because it's good or because it's BattleTech and I've subsumed my love of BattleTech for part of my identity, mm-hmm. right? I love Final Fantasy VII. It is a fantastic game. I love the story. I love the characters. I think it's great. Every time I load it up, a couple of years between playthroughs here and there, but every time I load it up, I always have a good time. I liked Final Fantasy VII Advent Children, the movie. I was really excited when it came out. It is not a good movie. It is a bad, bad movie. But I acknowledge it's many, 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 many flaws. So it's one of those things is, you know, do I like Far Country just because it's BattleTech? And I think it's mostly Star Trek really with a BattleTech coding.
It is. And the other thing I like about it too is it's not, the characters don't, I mean, obviously the mechs are important in the story, which is a really big plus.
Yeah.
Because the book that shall not be named, do they really need to be in there?
Yeah.
You know, but, man, where was I going to go with that?
Well, like for me, you know, I wonder, you know, what about Far Country? You know, do I like about it? And we've been talking about it for the past, you know, 30, 40 minutes.
Yeah.
There's a lot that I do like about it, and especially how strong the characters are, even though it's fairly simple, but Rice does manage to give you a good understanding of what the characters are like and their decisions and what they'll make, decisions they would make in the future based on what we get. And, you know, again, you know, do I like Far Country just because it's BattleTech? Well, I can tell you after reading a couple books recently, I do not like something just because it's got BattleTech on the cover. I can tell you that straight up.
Yeah.
But I do like Far Country. I did want to read it, you know, to the end. You know, and this is the second time I've read it. It's been separated by like a decade since I read it the first time. But, you know, having read it, yeah, I mean, it's fun. And if you guys can get past the Tetate, because again, they're never going to show up again. It's never going to factor in any spine novel. It's never going to decide the fate of the Inner Sphere. You know, it's just, it's an adventurous novel. It's an adventure novel. It is experimental. It does something different from any other BattleTech novel. It's worth reading.
It's like one of those legends, like Clan Wolverine. They're not coming back. I don't care what anyone says.
No, they're not coming back. They can drop hints all they want.
Who cares about them?
Apparently, Smoke Jaguars can come back.
Ugh. We didn't even get that epic Ill Clan cover.
No, we didn't.
We didn't get that epic battle. But you know what? We got birds with spears.
We got birds with spears. We got birds with motherfucking spears.
And they worship locusts.
So yeah, guys, that is our take on Far Country.
Yeah, but I'm with Adam. It's definitely worth a read. This is my first time actually fully reading it, because I was caught up with everyone else, like all sentient beings. It's probably a dumb book. And what kept me from reading it was honestly the community.
Yeah.
You know, but then after reading Hour of the Wolf, I was like, because after seeing your reaction to it, I was like, you know what? And this is going to allude to our next episode that's coming down the line.
Yeah.
I'm going to go back and read Far Country, and I want to actually see if that book is worse than Hour of the Wolf.
Yeah.
And we could tell you, Hour of the Wolf is definitely worse.
Yeah.
Than Far Country.
Yeah. I think there's definitely a difference between what happens in Hour of the Wolf and what I would like to have seen. But I think a lot of my problems with Hour of the Wolf are, in fact, structural. How it's written, how it's paced, how it's put together. Those are my bigger problems. So it's almost like a Plinkett review for Star Wars. You know, it's not, oh, well, Boba Fett, blah, 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 should have done because he's so awesome. No, it's not that. It's here are my problems with how the story actually unfolds and what it tries to do and what I don't think it succeeds at. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I like the Tetate.
Yeah, Tetate. Yeah. Pro Tetate.
Yep.
Cool, guys. Well, enjoy that. Have fun. Give it a go.
Yeah, and if you really want to, give Sunlust a go. While you're at it. I am driving myself crazy.
Yeah. There really are some good Doom mods. I think there's actually a MechWarrior 2 Doom mod, isn't
yep.
there?
Yep. Mech Doomer. There's Mech a guy. Doomer. I don't know if he's still working on it, but it looks great.
Yeah.
There you yeah, go. Guys, until the next episode.
Yeah. Good times. Good times.